Good morning, everyone. We're only 5 minutes late. We do have a quorum. I would like to call the committee to order. Thank you all for getting here bright and early on a Friday morning. Before we begin, I would like to introduce, we have another new page in our committee, Elliot Albright. I don't know if he's related to
Representative Albright. Anybody that's named Albright's good in my book.
Okay. So we're going to give Elliot, we're going to give you a minute to just please introduce yourself to us and everybody will know who you are. You can just do it right from there. It's just
okay,
fine.
Sounds good. I'm Elliot Albright, resident of West St. Paul, native of Apple Valley. I'm just glad to be here.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thanks, Elliot.
And then I think we have also, I'm seeing here a new member from, I think from GOP Research. If you could please introduce yourself. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Gabrielle Suge, and I'm just filling in for Harry Kennedy today.
Okay. Welcome, Gabrielle.
Thanks.
Okay. So we are ready to hear House File 2306, Representative Lane. Let's see. Where are we going after this? Okay, so thank you. Okay, so we will this bill is our intention is to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. So members, just so you know, we won't be voting on the bill today. Representative Lane, go ahead and present House File 2306.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll start you off again with another bill on funeral homes. Currently, all funeral homes need to have a properly furbished embalming room, and it costs like $30,000 to have one of those. So now if a funeral home wants to open a branch office as more of a storefront that sells services and products but doesn't have any bodies at that locale, they do all their work for on the bodies and storage of bodies at another locale, then they don't need an embalming room at that branch site. So this just the statute is a change to allow them to do that. It comes from the Department of Health, and it has agreement of all stakeholders, all people involved, and it comes out of a court case where the judge is requiring this. So it's very simple.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lane. We have a testifier. I don't see. Is Mr. McGrath here?
Yeah.
Lee McGrath? Okay. I don't see Mr. McGrath here. Is there anyone from the public who wants to testify for or against this bill? Anyone who wants to testify for or against the bill? Any questions from members? Any discussion?
I'm sorry. What was the question? I do have a question.
Oh, please go ahead, Representative Albright. Time for questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. For Representative Lane, in your summary of the bill, you suggested that, and maybe I didn't hear you correctly, but that this would require or not require each funeral home office to contain an embalming room.
It actually changes. Thank you, Madam Chair. It actually changes the statute that requires all funeral establishments to have an embalming room and allows them to have a locale which would not have an embalming room.
Representative Albright. So, Representative Albright, it's taking away a current requirement for some establishments.
Okay. And that sounds like a good thing.
So,
I'm just curious why we have to put that in statute.
Because the statute, thank you, Madam Chair. The statute now says that all funeral establishments need to have an embalming room, and actually somebody brought it to the court. Court case saying that if I want to open a branch office, I shouldn't have to pay for an embalming room if I'm not going to do any work on bodies there. And the court said, you're right. And so now we have to change statute.
Representative Albright.
I'm curious. The lawsuit, who were the litigants to that?
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. a funeral director named Verlin Stoll was the one who was the funeral director, and the Institute of Justice is the one who brought the case.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
May I just ask what precipitated the lawsuit?
Representative Lane.
There might be some mixed feelings as to as that. I know the Institute of Justice is looking for cases where they can reduce the requirements of law, and they have some cases where they want to help funeral directors in this, and at least some of them. So they brought this case. The Department of Health was actually willing to move ahead with some of this, but they went ahead with the case, and they want a very limited judgment, and this statute fulfills that requirement of the judge.
Representative Albright. That's the organization that Lee McGrath represents, and he isn't here, that he would have been testifying on it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair, he actually has in agreement with the statute change.
Yeah, so he would have been testifying in support.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Other members? Questions? Discussion? All right. All right. Thank you, Representative Lane. This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. All right. Next, we will hear House File 2307, Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
And Representative Schoen is going to move that House File 2307 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, welcome, Representative Schoen. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, every one of the districts we represent have been adversely affected by the tragedies related to opiate-based painkiller and heroin overdoses. Some of you may have neighbors and loved ones who have succumbed to the perils of addiction. Over the years, many have become reliant on opiate-based painkillers like oxycodone, and many have graduated to heroin when they can no longer obtain or afford the prescription-based opiates. Minnesota has the dubious distinction of having some of the purest heroin in the country, and as a result, it is also some of the deadliest. An addict will not know from time to time how pure the heroin they are injecting in their arm is. It's easy for many in society to cast aside those with these addictions and not want to help them. I've had the fortune or misfortune in many circumstances to get to know those addicted to opiates in my work as a police detective working on a narcotics task force. These people really do come from every community, every age range, and every walk of life. I've dealt with high school kids, law school students, medical professionals, and millionaires. Most were far from homeless, disheveled stereotype portrayed in the movies. In this bill, I'm asking you to allow law enforcement, first responders, and others who would be well positioned to help those in an overdose situation be able to provide a safe antidote which can reverse the deadly effects of an opiate overdose immediately, and this will save lives. In the clearest explanation, this law would allow responders such as law enforcement officers to carry this with them on patrol. In some parts of the state, law enforcement and first responder units can be 10, 20 minutes ahead of an ambulance crew. The ability to administer this medication in the case of a heroin or opiate-based painkiller overdose will be a difference between life and death, and the life-saving results will be immediately. This could be a heroin user or one of your children who recently had surgery and accidentally overdosed on a painkiller. In fact, I just got an email from work this morning talking about a new opiate-based painkiller called Zohydro that's going to be coming on the market in March that was recently approved by the FDA, and it makes Vicodin look like candy. So this is going to be prolific, and I'd like to move on to testifiers from there, and we'll move forward with more about the bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Schoen. So first, okay, so we have Dr. Charlie Reznikoff.
Madam Chair, I believe Dr. Reznikoff was stuck at HCMC actually seeing patients. He may make it by the time we're done. If we're not, we'll just move forward with him.
Okay. So Cody Weiberg from the Board of Pharmacies coming. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, and I'm here to speak in support of this bill. The Board of Pharmacy did consider this legislation at one of its regularly scheduled public meetings a few months back. And in fact, I helped draft the language in Section 1 because that's a section of the Minnesota Pharmacy Practice Act. The Board of Pharmacy strongly supports making naloxone more widely available for administration. This is a life-saving drug. It is a specific opiate antagonist, which means it very rapidly reverses the effects of an opiate overdose. I can also tell you that the agencies that comprise the state substance abuse strategy also support the provisions of the bill that make the more widespread distribution of naloxone a possibility. I can also finally just tell you that I know about this not just because I was trained as a pharmacist, but I've actually seen this drug save people's lives. I worked my way through college and pharmacy school as a ward clerk in the university hospital emergency room, and my first full-time job out of pharmacy school was as a poison information specialist at Hennepin County Medical Center, and poison specialists went up for all the overdoses. So I've actually seen this drug work. It's incredible. It has an onset within a minute, and it is critical to treat someone with an opiate overdose as quickly as possible. Essentially, the reason that people die from opiate overdoses is their breathing stops. And this drug will rapidly reverse the effects of the opiate so that the breathing is restored. So, again, I would encourage the committee to look favorably upon this bill.
Are there questions for members for Dr. Weiberg? I have one. Mm-hmm. Why is it that this has been restricted up until now? I understand that this is a drug that really doesn't have any addictive effect on its own. And could you just explain why we need to be here doing this today, making it more widely available when it's such an obvious lifesaver and doesn't have any real downside?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think there's a couple of reasons why we're seeing this now. The basic reason that this legislation is necessary is naloxone is a legend drug or a prescription drug. So typically it can only be administered on prescription. Or order of a prescriber. So that's one reason right there. This law would actually allow prescribers to enter into agreements with certain types of individuals for the use of this drug without an order being given in advance. That's one reason. The other reason is naloxone, as it's approved by the Food and Drug Administration, is an injectable drug. And it's only been recently in the last few years that a compounded preparation that can be injected intranasally has been introduced. And that means that you now have a preparation that you could have a wider range of people administer because that Representative Schoen can speak more to this than me, but I'm sure that in most law enforcement vehicles, they're not set up to do IVs, but now we have a product that they could actually carry with them and administer. So I think that's why you're seeing this sort of legislation now.
Okay, thank you. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schoen or the testifier, I'm just wondering, are there any other groups that would be rational to include? You know, I'm thinking of some of the large school districts where we know there are problems, and they do have nurses on station. So have you considered expanding to areas like that, or state colleges, or other places where there are large numbers of young people who sometimes get engaged in this activity?
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, the in Subdivision 12, Section 1, it basically, by the description you describe, if they have the nurse, if they have the advanced practice nurse, the physician assistant, or an agreement with a doctor that basically serves as medical direction, then absolutely they could establish the program.
Well, thank you. I need to read it more carefully, don't I?
No, that's your
Representative Schoen. Sorry.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Mack had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a brief question. I see in the bill under definitions of opiate antagonist, it lists the drug naloxone. Is that how you pronounce it? And I'm just curious, is that the only drug right now? I hear you say it's not addictive. And I see it says naloxone, hydrochloride, or any similarly acting drug. At this point, is that the only drug like this that exists to combat an overdose?
Dr. Weiberg?
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, in this context, yes. Naloxone would be the only drug that could be used in this context at this point in time.
Thank you, Madam
Mack. Okay. Other questions, members?
And Madam Chair, you know, our intent in extension of that would be is if there would be a drug that was developed sometime in the future that it would fit with that definition as well, as long as it's an opioid antagonist that is similar and wouldn't have any addictive or problematic qualities that the Board of Pharmacy would see as a problem.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I think we can go to our next testifier. Thank you. So our next testifier is Lexi Reed Holtum. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you all for having me here today. I'm a little bit nervous.
Yeah, all you have to do is tell us your name first, and then you can go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lexi Reed Holtum. I am Vice President of the Steve Remler Hope Foundation, and Steve was my fiancé. He is the namesake of this bill. Steve was, we lived in Eden Prairie. Steve was a financial planner and one of the best in the Twin Cities. He was an athlete, a loving family member. He was a graduate of the University of Minnesota with honors. He ran marathons. He was pretty much your standard, really amazing guy. He was my first love in high school and college, and then we came back together again in our 40s. Steve had an injury in 1997 that left him having nerve pain. Every day when he woke up, he had pain. He was really lucky. We were really lucky. We came from families of means. We had resources. We were both able to see some of the best doctors. And as we all know, Minnesota is a really phenomenal place to get medical care. Steve's really well-intending doctors couldn't quite figure out what the problem was at first and prescribed him benzodiazepines. Moving along in the years, they were able to find a contusion on his spine and able to diagnose that he had some nerve pain that was going on. At that point, they prescribed him opioids to deal with his pain. He was prescribed morphine and then OxyContin, and also at the same time with the benzodiazepines and then Vicodin. Slowly, he developed an addiction to these pills. First he got dependency and then he developed an addiction. Once his addiction was in full-blown force, he started doctor shopping. He found a doctor that was willing to prescribe him any amount of anything that he wanted at any point. That doctor has since lost his license to practice medicine in Minnesota. So Steve, in 2011, had gone to Hazelden to go to treatment, successfully completed the program. It was a wonderful program. He got out. The disease of addiction had already taken over his way of functioning. He got out and could no longer find solutions to how to handle his pain, how to handle the stress and anxiety of it, and relapsed. 45 days after he got out of Hazelden, he tried heroin for the first time. He was no longer able to get his prescription pills anymore. As I said, his doctor that was willing to prescribe him anything had lost his license to prescribe. And Steve had been forthcoming with all of us and his other really well-intending doctors about the fact that he had the disease of addiction. So no one was willing to prescribe to him anymore. He sought out heroin, got it, and used it for the first time. And upon using it for the first time, he overdosed and died. The reason why we are creating this bill is because Steve was, or bringing it before you, is because Steve was one of 16,000 people in 2011 that died from an overdose to prescription pills as their main cause. We feel that the other 17 states and the District of Columbia have set a really good track record as to why this is a successful thing to do in states. It's very successful in Quincy, Massachusetts. It's successful in Virginia, California, Connecticut, Illinois, Massachusetts, New York. The list goes on and on. I'm happy to give you all the states if you want. So we feel that if we're able to create this legislation, that what will happen is we'll start to see the numbers of deaths in Minnesota go down. I know that I'm on a coalition with people who are just like me. Some of them are in the room. Every single one of them would testify. It is just tragic. Steve is not the only one who lost his life, and this is preventable. And I thank you so much for your time. Thank you for bearing with me as I'm nervous today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. You did an excellent job. Being nervous did not stop you at all. Members, any questions? Okay, I'm not seeing any right now, so thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, if I may indulge just for a second, Lexi showed up at my doorstep saying, well, this is a problem. What do we do? She now is a lobbyist because she's been here so much, but this is the first time she's ever been here. She didn't even know where to go, what office to get to, who might help her figure out where a bill should go and even what you do to type up to make a bill look right. And so it took a lot of courage for her, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you.
This is truly what we're here for.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Sheriff Stanek, is he here? Ah. Welcome to the committee.
Hey, Madam Chair, members, thanks very much. My name is Rich Stanek. I'm a sheriff in Hennepin County. I brought with me something today. This is a what naloxone looks like in a box form, what folks would have. And if you want to take a look at it, you're welcome to, as long as I get it back at the end. I need this. Life-saving.
Yeah, we could pass that around if the page would take that and just can send it around the table.
Well, Madam Chair, members, thank you also for the opportunity to be here this morning and for you to bring this bill up and give Representative Schoen a hearing on it. Look, we've been working on this legislation along with Senator Eaton for several months now, Lexi and Cody, myself, and others. And as you may know, we're seeing a heroin epidemic nationwide and across the state of Minnesota. The statistics are nothing short of alarming. According to the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, the ONDCP, about 50 people die every day in this country from an opiate-based overdose, including prescription drugs and heroin. Last year in Hennepin County, just on the other side of the river from here, we had 56 deaths caused by a heroin overdose. It's a 51% increase over 2012 and an 833% increase over just a few years ago. You look at the chart on my left here, you can see from 2013, 56 deaths. 2010, we had 8 deaths. When we had 8 deaths, we thought that was a lot. Law enforcement had not seen heroin overdoses for quite some time like this across the metro area. We talked to our narcotics task forces, our detectives, the medical profession, medical examiners, emergency room doctors, and we started talking about this from a preventative and education aspect. And now here we are 3 years later, and the numbers have just skyrocketed. We're making an impact, but you guys can do something else to help us with an impact, and that is that box that we're passing around here, naloxone or Narcan. Once a prescription drug runs out, people are turning to heroin because of the availability, the purity, and the price all make it very attractive. We've been working hard to raise public awareness, as I said. Now, we've held numerous town hall meetings, press conferences, and even had volunteers out at the great Minnesota Get-Together State Fair this past fall to educate parents and kids about the dangers of heroin and prescription drug abuse. We encourage people to dispose of unwanted prescription drugs at 6 drop-off sites across Hennepin County, and I know other metro area law enforcement agencies are doing the same. But just to put it in perspective, in the last 18 months or so, we've taken 10 tons, 19,500 pounds of unwanted, unused, expired medications from citizens who turn them into us and then we disposed of them. 19,500 pounds, just shy of 10 tons. In addition to prevention, we must also address the issue of preventable deaths due to heroin and opiate overdose. Now, this House File 2307 gives law enforcement and first responders the ability to save lives as a first responder to an overdose emergency by administering naloxone or Narcan. This is important because, Madam Chair, members, oftentimes it's law enforcement, folks like myself and Representative Schoen and the people who work with us and for us, who are the first responders to a 911 call. And when we're called to an overdose, those seconds make a difference in saving people's lives. You heard from Lexi, you heard from Cody, you'll hear from others as this bill progresses through the legislature over the next several weeks. And although naloxone is a prescription drug, it is not a controlled substance and has no abuse potential. It's regularly carried by paramedics on ambulance crews and in area emergency rooms. But current Minnesota law does not allow for law enforcement or first responders to administer this life-saving drug, naloxone. Firefighters can carry it only if trained as a paramedic, and there are certain law enforcement agencies in Minnesota, like I think Cottage Grove still does, trained as paramedics. But I want to make sure that my deputies and other first responders statewide are equipped with this. Now, we've seen success with law enforcement use of Narcan in other jurisdictions across the country. And again, Madam Chair, members, Lexi touched on this ever so briefly, but in Quincy, Massachusetts, they have seen 188 heroin overdose reversals since 2010. That's 188 people who did not die as a result of this life-saving medication being administered by first responders out at the scene. In Suffolk County, New York, there were 108 reversals and another 108 lives saved just last year. 17 other states in the District of Columbia have amended their laws, like I'm asking Minnesota to do, to address naloxone, resulting in over 10,000 overdose reversals since 2001. It's a lot of folks. I think with the passage of House File 2307 as it progresses through, we're going to do what we can to greatly reduce the number of heroin and opiate overdose deaths in Hennepin County and in the state of Minnesota. And Madam Chair, members, the Minnesota Sheriff's Association has concerns about parts of this bill dealing with liability, but that is an issue for another day. I just wanted to raise it with you. Representative Schoen's well aware of it, and we're going to deal with it as we move through. At the end of the day, what we want is for first responders to be able to carry what's being passed around the committee table. And thank you very much for allowing me to testify this morning. I'm happy to take questions if you wish, and or, you know, as this bill progresses through.
Right. Thank you, Sheriff Stanek. We do have some questions, so please stay there. And I just want to thank you for reminding me to sort of flag for members that even though we have law enforcement sitting at the table, that Sheriff Stanek very graciously confined his remarks to the health impacts of this, the health aspect. Sometimes it's kind of intertwined, as it is in this bill, but just so everybody knows, we're not here today to discuss the law enforcement aspects. That would be for another committee. So with that, Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome back.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask, and it's probably in the bill, but what about out in greater Minnesota, like Faribault, where I'm from, in the first responders, the EMTs? Are they going to be able to use this?
Representative Schoen?
Madam Chair and Representative Fritz, in fact, when our next testifier comes up, I'm also going to amend the bill, which clarifies that specific piece for the basic life support ambulances to clarify that, but the ultimate answer is yes.
Good. Thank you.
All right. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sheriff Stanek, I have a couple questions for you. The first is to your chart, and that's almost a threefold increase from 2010 to 2011. Could you just speak to what happened between 2010 and 2011?
Sheriff Stanek?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, Representative, that's a great question. What I told folks as recent as just a couple weeks ago with U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar and others in a town hall forum at Hazelden is that, look, four out of five people, much like Lexi's fiancé, get addicted to opioids as a result of prescription pain pills. Four out of five. And when they can no longer get access to prescription pain pills, they turn to heroin. Now, why heroin? Heroin is cheap here in the Twin Cities. it is extremely pure here in the Twin Cities. Unlike 20, 25 years ago, when using heroin had this stigma of having to tie something around your arm, heat it up on a spoon, and then inject it, very invasive, right? It's not like that anymore, Madam Chair members. You can ingest it, inject it, you know, take it orally, smoke it. They've made it much more available, much more attractive to younger customers to use. You'll see it packaged, and I did not bring it this morning because I couldn't find the deputy to bring over the $50,000 display of heroin. We just don't let it wander around. But you'll see it packaged up in little colorful balloons. You'll see it in tin foil. You'll see it in little bindles. Extremely easy to find.
Sheriff Stanek, how would the first... there's two sections to this bill, and I appreciate if you just avail me to a little levity, because I know that you're not here to talk to the prosecution side of it. But to the extent of how would this bill either avail your department to better prosecution or better assistance in availing people that are heroin addicts to help or to prevention recovery programs? Is there a path that you can see that makes that better for addicts, or does this to some extent prevent them from seeking help?
Sheriff Stanek?
Hey, Madam Chair, members, you know, that's a great question as well. I'll tell you two things. One, the day before last, I was at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. I went there at 8 o'clock in the morning to speak to their group. They had about 400 inpatient residents. These are young men and women, middle-aged, a little bit older. They came in all shapes and sizes, race, ethnicities, and backgrounds. And I asked a tough question. How many of you here as a result of prescription pain pill or heroin abuse? Well over the majority of them raised their hands. In fact, one young lady came to me at the end and said, look, she knows three friends in her group, in her quad setting, that had overdosed, and the effects were reversed with the use of Narcan and Naloxone. Now, they were able to make it to the emergency room. They're lucky. Some folks aren't. First responders, law enforcement, our job is to save lives first and foremost. Beyond anything else, it's to save lives. That's why I'm here this morning representing this bill. We're going to deal with the other aspect of it at some point. Now, everything's a negotiation, but we understand, and I think our friends who may disagree understand that first and foremost, law enforcement and first responders want to be able to save lives out on the streets.
Representative Albright?
Madam Chair?
Representative Schultz?
Just a point to Representative Albright's question. They're not getting treatment if they're dead.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
May I just respond to that,
Madam Representative Chair? Albright?
And this is not to agree to disagree to that to the author of the bill, but the point is that I think we're not so much, we are concerned. It's a very tragic circumstance, and Lexi was in my office yesterday, and I heard the story, and it's a tale that I've heard over and over again, and it's a sad one. But the point is, at some point, even the friends of the victim, you have to come to a point, whether it's at your bottom or otherwise, where you recognize either for your own self or for others that you need help. And the concern that I have, and it's shared by others, is how are we facilitating a constructive assistance for those that might otherwise continue and perpetuate that habit? How do we stop the addiction cycle if we're, in this case, perpetuating the addiction? And I appreciate your response to, is the second part of this bill, to some extent, a perpetuation of an addictive process that the friends are following, and in terms of if they're granted immunity?
Well, Representative Albright, you're getting off in the weeds on the wrong topic. I mean, we're not here to talk about Section 3. Mm-hmm. Of course, I've made it very clear to several people in this room that Section 3 is not going to survive the way it stands in the bill right now. So if that answers your question, we can move forward from that. Then let's do so. But Section 3 will not survive as it stands, and I think everybody understands that pretty clearly. But we've got a long ways to go, but we're just not going to deal with that today because we want to work out the right language, which gets to the spirit of what we're trying to get at, but absolutely guides people that need assistance and make sure that they get the care that they need. And sometimes they need a strong hand to force them to get the help they need. So we will move forward in that direction. Do you have my assurance on that?
Representative Schoen, I was not made aware that Section 3 was going to be worked over, so I appreciate your comments on that, and that makes my comfort for this bill a little better.
Yeah, and Representative Albright, we are intending to move this to Judiciary, and I think you can be assured that it will get worked over in Judiciary. If you've been on Judiciary or seen it in action. So, okay, Representative Francis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Sheriff Stanek. Does this bill in any way, shape, or form create a false sense of security for those that do use, or for family members or friends? You know, let's just say somebody was saved. Okay, you saved this life, and they're like, oh, well, you know, I overdosed once. I don't have to change my behaviors because Sheriff Stanek will show up again. Or the family member says, well, you know, okay, we'll try to work on this, but, you know, if you do overdose again, we'll make sure we call for help right away. And that's my big concern, is I don't want to see this false sense of security or repeat of users, because at the end of the day, we want, obviously, people to somehow get off this heroin issue.
Representative Sheriff Stanek.
Either or, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, you know, at the end of the day, really what it comes down to is, what's the alternative? Every time you use heroin, you never know how pure it's going to be. You never know what those that sold it to you or provided it to you cut it with. That is why we're seeing, you're just seeing the deaths up here. You're not seeing the numbers for the emergency room admissions, or the collateral damage to people's lives. So, number one, look, there's a lot of great folks out there that can deal with the addiction piece, getting them into treatment, helping them find the help, or getting them that guiding hand, as Dan referenced. But at the end of the day, when law enforcement and first responders get there, our job is to save their life. We run into this all the time. You know, people driving down the road, they drive off, the car flips over. Am I going to chastise them for not wearing a seatbelt? No, I'm going to save their life. Folks who go out and, you know they're allergic to whatever it might be, but they're still going to go out and enjoy the great outdoors. They may carry an EpiPen with them. We're going to save their life. That's what I want to do with this, first and foremost. And I want to be crystal clear about that. We're going to deal with the other piece, and this legislature did deal with the immunity provision with binge drinking. It was binge drinking, right, Eric?
Yeah.
Binge drinking just a year or two ago.
Right.
We can figure this out, but first and foremost, we want to save their life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Representative Franson? Okay, thank you. We've got more members with questions. And members, Dr. Reznikoff is here as well, so if your question is to Sheriff Stanek, that's fine. We'll keep him here as long as you like, but if your questions are more general, you might want to hold off, and you've got another medical expert here as well. So, Representative Zerwas?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be brief. To the author, thank you for bringing this bill forward, and thank you for the meetings that we've had and our prior discussions about Section 3. And I think just a general comment for the committee, and I thank Sheriff Stanek for his presentation and his chart. However, I think those numbers are unbelievably misleading. And so I think, you know, 22 deaths in 2011, 37 deaths in 2012, and 56 deaths in 2013 is a drop in the bucket to the thousands and thousands and thousands of people that are having their lives turned upside down by not just heroin, but opioid addiction in general. And I think it behooves us not only to look at public policy on the back end, what can we do in a last resort to save someone's life? But what we can do about the prescription, over-prescription of opiates, and it's not a Minnesota problem, it's a national problem. When you have enough opioids prescribed in one area of Florida to fill prescriptions in all of the United States at one point, you know, in a month snapshot in 2011, clearly there's an issue here that needs to be addressed more than this, and I look forward to working on that with Representative Schoen in the future, and I look forward to getting this bill in a position with Section 3 addressed that we can all support. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. And I think you're certainly correct that this is not addressing the entire issue, and you know, as you know, there are going to be other bills in front of this committee this year that are going to look at different pieces of this, different ways it might be addressed, but clearly this is not the answer to the problem, even if it were to pass, you know, as it is. Okay, Representative Huntley.
Just a comment about the treatment. And we passed a bill last year, and there's a big debate in the medical community about how to treat people that have this addiction. One group believes that total abstinence is the only way out, and if you read the Minneapolis paper about 2 weeks ago, there was an editorial saying that methadone is the only way out, a lifetime of methadone. So there's a debate in the healthcare community about what to do. And I don't think it's our position to try to tell the medical community what the best way to go, but there were some abuses with the methadone program, and we addressed that in last year's session. So there's two ways to treat these people, and works for some, doesn't work for others.
Okay, thank you, Representative Huntley. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and mine is actually to how the bill creates the authority, and it provides that a licensed physician assistant, or licensed advanced practice registered nurse can issue the standing order. And I would assume that everyone within the EMT community has a medical director, and that that would typically be the person who does it, but perhaps Sheriff Stanek or yourself or the author can respond to, in the law enforcement area, is there typically a relationship with a particular medical director, that sort of thing? I mean, this just seemed kind of broad, and I don't know if you want within a larger law enforcement agency, you know, different people getting orders from different things. And so I'm just wondering if our wording here works for the way law enforcement works. I just don't know.
Representative Schoen or?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members.
Panic.
What we're looking for is for a standing order from a physician to be able to administer this. We are not, our police officers, my deputies are not, you know, the vast majority of them are not emergency medical technicians. None of them are paramedics. They're cops. They're first responders. They have basic life support or basic first aid training. Maybe the doctor can address this better when he speaks. But again, I don't have a medical director in my organization. We work with the Hennepin County Medical Center and or North Memorial in my county.
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was my question. I just didn't know if police departments typically had a relationship with someone they named a medical director, and if we should reference that, and you've answered the question. Thank you.
All right. I think now, thank you, Sheriff Panic, and if you can stick around, that would be great. I don't know if you have to rush away, but...
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Dr. Reznikoff. Yeah, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Please just give your name for the record, and then you can go ahead and give your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Charles Reznikoff. Can I begin?
Please.
Thanks for everyone's attention and time. Thanks for considering this bill. My name is Charlie Reznikoff. I'm an internal medicine doctor at Hennepin County Medical Center, general medical doctor. Also, I'm an addiction medicine doctor at Hennepin County Medical Center and in Northfield, Minnesota, at the Northfield Hospital. And in addition to that, I work in pain care at Hennepin County Medical Center. I also work at the University of Minnesota teaching pain medication prescribing. I think we've heard a lot about the problem, so I don't think I need to go on about the problem, the rash of opioid overdose deaths, heroin, and prescription medications. Our state is probably average. That's not a good thing for prescription medications, and maybe even a little worse than average for heroin. It's a problem. It's not just in the metro area. You know, I have a pretty active clinic in Rice County, and I see people in other surrounding areas. And so it's a problem, and I think we all are aware of that. We've seen the headlines, celebrity and otherwise, overdose deaths. But I guess we're here to talk more about solutions, and I just want to talk a little bit about naloxone and what naloxone offers and some information about it. Naloxone is often sometimes called Narcan. That's the trade name. It can be given intranasally, squirt up the nose, or it can be given intravenously. If you're not on opioids, it will do nothing. I mean, it will have no effect on you. It's not a controlled substance. It's not addictive. It's not harmful in any way. In fact, it may, if you squirted naloxone up my nose, I probably wouldn't even notice something happened other than the squirt. So it is totally neutral to one not on opioids. To one on opioids, it causes, and I've seen this, sudden and pretty dramatic withdrawal, which can be life-saving. It's also very uncomfortable. It's not, if you're on opioids, the last thing you would do on a whim would be take Narcan. It is the last resort for those folks. Their world gets turned inside out for 40 minutes of pretty excruciating pain. Not life-threatening, but excruciating pain where all of your pain is firing all at once. But you wake up and you live. So this is not fun for the pain. I've seen it. I've seen people's overdoses reversed in the emergency room, and they wake up screaming, but they're alive. So this, just to clarify what happens to those folks, this is not something that anyone would do trivially. And yet, they're not doing it to themselves anyways. It's their friends that are assisting them, or a first responder who's assisting them in saving their lives. That's one thing. The other thing I wanted to say is there's a lot of talk about addiction, and I'm an addiction doc, and I'm happy to field questions on addiction, treatment of addiction, but this is not just about addiction. This is an area in which pain and addiction are aligned. We got a lot of people out there, older folks, folks with breathing problems, that are in pain on strong pain meds. And you take someone with some breathing problems like emphysema, put them on pain meds, we have a patient in the hospital now whose kidney, they got dehydrated, kidney stopped working, and a 60-year-old woman, not an addict, accidentally overdosed on morphine. She did nothing wrong. She took her pills exactly as prescribed every day, but she got dehydrated, her kidney stopped purifying her blood, and the morphine built up. And she's not an addict, but Narcan could have saved her life. Luckily, she got to the hospital in time. So this is a rescue that doesn't just apply to addicts. This applies to people in pain on strong narcotics. Just to be clear on that, I guess my final, I want to make a few comparisons you've heard, and then I want to take your questions, help you as much, answer any further questions. I had a friend a couple years ago who got a bee sting out in the boonies. And luckily, there was someone with a first aid kit there. And what didn't happen was people standing around wondering whether we'd be sued for giving this person an EpiPen for saving her life for having a bee sting. And what did happen is, and there was an EpiPen available there. And we called 911, but we also gave her the EpiPen. And this is not so different from that. It's another example you've heard, you know a lot about, I'm sure, is the external defibrillators, the AEDs in shopping malls and libraries and airplanes. And someone has a heart attack. You don't have people standing around wondering, am I going to get sued by putting this AED on them? It's a pretty dummy-proof device. You put it on, you press go, and it takes care of the rest. And you call 911, and you save the person's life. And that's the kind of thing we're talking about. It's pretty dummy-proof. It's pretty abuse-proof. And it can save lives. And with all those other conditions, if you have a heart attack in a sporting game and someone puts that shock on you, you still need to go take care of your heart condition. You still need to back off on the salt shaker, whatever it is. It doesn't exempt you from taking care of your health. It's just getting you alive, getting you to the next step. And then, yeah, then that person needs to take care of their health. And the person with the bee sting needs to use a little more common sense about where they're camping or you know, et cetera. So those are my comments. I really appreciate your attention. I'll wrap up and I'll take any questions you all have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And your testimony is riveting, so I don't know how we could not give you our attention.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. So what I'm hearing you, I don't know if you were in the room when we had the question about a false sense of security,
yeah,
and maybe that's what you're kind of talking about, but your testimony about what happens to someone when they get the naloxone is kind of, that seems to me to kind of go to that question, because after, I assume that after you've been through that, you wouldn't say, oh, well, I'm going to not worry about overdosing because I'll just have that experience again and everything will be fine. I imagine that would be sort of a deterrent to that false sense of security, at least. Would that be sort of your, would you agree with that?
Well, absolutely, and remember, no one's using this on themselves. It's always someone using it because they're comatose. And all opiate users, if there is a primary fear or motivation, it's the avoidance of withdrawal. And withdrawal usually creeps up slowly over 24 hours. This is withdrawal hits you in 15 minutes or less, 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. So it hits them like a brick wall. It is very uncomfortable. They would almost no opiate user would choose to put themselves into withdrawal. That's what causes all the problems. They're desperate to stay out of withdrawal. No one would. This is not a pleasant experience for them. However, they also know when they're in the room with someone who's dying that this person's dying. And an opiate user would deploy this, or a first responder would deploy, or a friend or a family member would deploy this, and then witness someone in a lot of pain for 45 minutes, but they'll be alive and they'll be breathing. So if that answers your question.
Yes, thank you. And I do have another question, but I'm going to first go to Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. And, Doctor, I'm curious how fast, how quickly this has to be administered once the person is comatose to save the person's life. What's the time frame in there?
Dr. Reznikoff.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. It would depend. It's so-called, if you stop having oxygen, go to the brain. I mean, you have on the order greater than 10 minutes to get, but past 10 minutes, you start having loss of function in the brain. So with all these things, whether it's a heart attack, a sudden cardiac arrest, or you stop breathing from an overdose, time is of the essence, but we're talking on the order of minutes. Many of these opiate overdoses, they don't totally shut off their breathing. They go to sort of 50% breathing, and those folks may have longer, such as 30 minutes after an overdose. Heroin's effect spans for 2 hours to 4 hours. So after you use heroin, it'll pretty quickly reaches its peak effect. And then if that's too much and you overdose, if it's a full overdose, you got 10 minutes. If it is a partial overdose, and that's common, you get close to death but not all the way there. You're doing brain damage, you're breathing 50%. You might have as much as 30 minutes, but you're talking about minutes.
Representative Johnson?
Yeah, Madam Chair, and maybe this is for the Representative Schoen, but I immediately think about the remote areas of Minnesota where first responders are local folks, volunteer firefighters, those folks. Are they included in this bill, or, you know, where it takes more than 10 minutes to get the EMS folks to the locale?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, yes, and in fact, I'll be, after we're done here, I'm going to move the A2 amendment, which will also clarify some things on that issue specifically, but this is really geared towards that to make it even better. If you're in Faribault County or where you are, or Douglas County, these are going to be some great pieces, yes.
Okay. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just a brief question for the doctor. What is the definition of overdose? Is the sign of overdose that the person is no longer conscious? How do you know if somebody's reached overdose level?
Right. Dr. Reznikoff.
Great, thank you, Madam Chair. Good question. Overdose would be different for different drugs, but in talking about opioids, the critical part of overdose would be slowed breathing or stopped breathing. I think the average person in the community might have a hard time counting breaths, look at your watch, put your hand on their chest and count the chest excursions or whatever. So that's not practical. So the practical definition of an opioid or heroin overdose is asleep and unable to wake up. If they're wake up, eyes open, talking, they're fine. But if they are unarousable, is what is the medical term, if they're unarousable from after using an opioid, I think that's a pretty safe assumption that it's an overdose. And again, if you give the Narcan wrongly, there's no harm. That's the sort of strict definition and the more practical, usable definition. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Since I don't see anybody else on the list, I'm going to ask my question. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, I also sense that there's a... I think you're dispelling a lot of our concerns and a lot of people's perhaps impressions about how easy this would be. Perhaps it would also help to say a little bit more about what happens after that 45 minutes of excruciating pain. People are not going to get up and start dancing. Can you tell us a little bit more about what happens in the following hours or days?
Dr. Resnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My mind is sort of reeling because I can answer that in a number of ways. For a single heroin ingestion, like a young person who tried it for the first time and used too much, they would reverse the overdose and go back to basically who they were before they tried the single heroin ingestion. That's one. For a medical illness where the morphine for pain had combined with their emphysema, they would be very uncomfortable for an hour, but they would still have those medical conditions at the end of that hour. They probably dodged the immediate bullet, but if they took the same medicine again the next day, they could have the same problem the next day. So they really need to readdress with their doctor their medications. And for the addict, I mean, addiction is chronic and there is no cure. We manage addictions, we don't cure it yet. For the addict, they have, usually that 45-minute antidote is enough to save their life. Then they either go back to their addictive behavior, excuse the expression, or they have a wake-up call. And hopefully this is the rock bottom that was, sort of alluded to earlier. You know, they wake up and they have a wake-up call, and they say, I can't keep doing this. I can't tell you which will happen. Some folks may go back to their prior behavior, and some folks may take it as a signal that it's time to stop. And I hope the latter, obviously. And those are a few different scenarios. Usually that 45-minute window is enough to save their life from the ingestion that caused the overdose, if that's the question.
Representative Ward?
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. So physiologically, people are going to be where they were before they consumed the narcotic.
It does not permanently change the body in any way.
I mean, they're not going to need to be hospitalized or any kind of... I mean, like I said, they're not going to get up and start dancing, but are there other
part of the
consequences like healing, rest, or something like that? Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Dr. Estrada,
thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry for interrupting. Yeah. I get excitable. part of the training for this should be administer the naloxone and call for help. And that should be part of the training. That should be part of this. Give epi for your bee sting. Don't go back out camping again. Mm. You know, you're not done. If you get a shock to wake yourself up after a heart attack, you don't go back to the sports game. You go to the hospital. So part of this should be go seek help. And that should be part of the training. And not just because it's the morally right thing to do, but it is a safe thing to do. And it's the morally right thing to do.
Thank you. And other questions from members? Okay, I do have another question. It's on the topic, but it's slightly off the bill, so I wanted to wait till the end. And that is that when Ms. Holtom testified and told the story of her fiancé, she talked about that he went to the heroin when he was essentially cut off the opioids that were prescribed to him. And I'm sure you're aware that one of the issues before our committee in this legislature this year has to do with our prescription monitoring program, whose goal is kind of that, to let prescribers know when somebody's doctor shopping. At least that's one of the goals of the program, and so that they presumably can refuse to give the drugs that they're being asked to give. And so I'm wondering if you can comment on that interaction. How common is it for that to be what moves somebody from the opioids to the heroin when their provider says, oh, wait a minute, I see there's a problem, better cut you off? And I know this is too big a topic for this hearing, but I'm just wondering if there's a, if that is a common sort of scenario where someone moves into heroin, whether there's a another way that we should approach this issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's, again, many possible answers to that, so I'll try to be focused. One is, yeah, that's a common scenario. In fact, a common scenario in someone struggling with pills is that they are already aware of heroin, if they haven't already used it. They don't may not be their primary thing, but someone who finally reaches the point of getting cut off their pills for doctor shopping often has had some ups and downs and run out early and been desperate once or twice already. So many of those folks already have gotten into, they're at least aware of it. And yeah, all too often when someone is cut off abruptly, they have this withdrawal, and like I described, it's an awful feeling and they're desperate to avoid withdrawal and they turn to heroin. So that is a very common scenario. And the intent of the PMP discovering that someone is doctor shopping, I hope the intent is to get them into treatment, whatever that treatment is. I mean, there is a debate about what treatment should be, but the next conversation should not be you're cut off, but the next conversation should be we need to help you get well because you're not well right now. And hopefully the PMP will hopefully get us to that spot and not just have people cut off. However, you know, many people do get cut off. And a couple sort of related comments. One is, again, as a general medical tool, a lot of docs are going to feel more comfortable prescribing medications and managing these pain meds if they can give the antidote with it. It is helpful. If I were to give insulin, sometimes people have low blood sugars and they need the reversal. So if you were not, as a doctor, to give insulin, it's very helpful to me to also have the low blood sugar antidote. And if I'm going to give opioids, even for the right reason to a non-addict, it's good to have that that antidote. And then if they ever get cut off, and if they ever get desperate, and if they still have an antidote available. I hope that answers your question.
Okay, thank you. And I think that, I know that Dr. Weiberg wants to come on this too, and I don't want to pull us too far off base, but I would love to talk with you offline about this further. Sure. when you have an opportunity. And so I don't know if we have other members on the list here. And I know Dr. Weiberg wants to comment, but I don't think I want to pull us off into the PMP discussion too far here. We're going to have plenty of time for that on another day. So we do have another testifier. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. If you can stick
around for a bit, just in case there are further questions, okay. That would be outstanding. I know you've probably got plenty to do today.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you so much for coming.
Okay, Madam Chair, this might be appropriate at this time to move the A2 amendment.
All right.
To the bill. Sorry, we didn't do that right off the get-go.
Okay, so Representative Schoen moves the A2 amendment. It's in your packets, members. And Representative Schoen, maybe, do you want to discuss that now or do you want to have Mr. McAlpin?
So I will direct you to page 2 on the amendment, Madam Chair.
Yes.
This is a technical correction because a physician assistant is not,
yes,
a physician's assistant. So
yes,
we're fixing that in on two lines. And then I will allow Mr. McAlpin to also more clearly explain why we're going with this language out of 144E.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, Buck McAlpin. I represent the Minnesota Academy of Emergency Physicians and the Minnesota Ambulance Association. We've talked extensively about this piece of legislation and support it. Lots of the testifiers obviously told you why it's probably a good piece. I think to maybe answer Representative Fritz and Representative Loeffler's questions, in Minnesota, still about 60% of our ambulance services are volunteer or EMT-based basic care. Representative Schoen and I, that are paramedics by trade, we could give this drug under our current training, but the medical director is the ultimate authority. We're required under our state statute to have a medical director to operate an ambulance in Minnesota. And the question earlier to Sheriff Stanek is, the interesting thing is about 6 or 7 large healthcare systems operate and oversight Mayo, North Memorial Health, East Helena, the large blanket of EMS in Minnesota. And with that comes medical training and medical director relationships. Sheriff Stanek's right, North Memorial, some of our medical directors oversee the first responders, the sheriffs. We have 8 regional EMS programs that have medical directors embedded in them that the state legislature supports financially. If a medical director can't be found, one's usually assigned through those regional programs. So as we talked about this, we did see it as an easy tool to roll out and be able to offer to our first responder networks. I think Representative Clark asked about distances. You get up to northwest Minnesota and southwest Minnesota, we have 40-minute response times to ambulance calls. So the first responders are an integral part, and that's usually the sheriff or Al leaving from his local garage in his pickup truck with his first in bag. The doctor talked about it eloquently. I liked his relationship between insulin and a drug he was referred to called glucagon. You have a low blood sugar issue from too much insulin, you give a little shot of glucagon in your cheek of your butt, and you wake right up 3 minutes later. This drug that Representative Schoen and I have both given is the same way. Some folks you see respond to it in 30 seconds, very angry, very mad, you ruin their high. And some it takes 10 or 15 minutes to recover to it. And in our medical protocols of what we do with naloxone, Narcan, and anti-antagonists like this now, is we've even changed from the definition of an overdose, and we call it for unconscious, unknown etiology. So if I come into your home and you're on the floor and I have no idea why I can't wake you up and you have a pulse and your respirations are slow, we give you sugar, usually, called D50, and we give you 2 milligrams of Narcan. Because the doctor's right, the Narcan is benign, it doesn't do anything to you, and if that wakes you up and you look at us, we want your respirations to recover and do that. So what we've asked Representative Schoen to do here, Madam Chair and members, is under our basic life support ambulance statutes is to add the definition, including administration of an opioid antagonist. We'd want to be sure that our local ambulances are rural ones that are carrying epinephrine for anaphylaxis and glucagon, and things approved now under their medical directors could also be added to this list, and they would carry that also.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for members on the amendment? Representative Albright.
This is for the testifier. Is it always the same dosage?
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, it's usually pretty standard across our system that we give 2 milligrams. There are, and Madam Chair, our medical director, when we go online, we can go online and talk to a physician anywhere in the state of Minnesota and through our medical resource centers. If they don't wake up, we say, well, it's a 400-pound patient, he may ask us to double that dose, just based off size or what type of patient we're dealing with.
Representative Albright, okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Schoen.
Representative Albright left me with something that maybe other people might be thinking. The dosage that would be given out by the first responder that showed up doesn't need to be titrated by weight. It doesn't change for male, female, pregnant, not pregnant, none of that. It's just you can give what's in the injector, all of it, and that's all you need to worry about.
Representative Albright.
So it basically functionally is akin to an EpiPen in terms of the delivery mechanism.
Representative Schoen.
Correct.
Right. Okay. Other questions for members on the amendment? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Okay. We've got the A2 amendment. Is there any further testimony on the bill as amended? Anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? Okay, and I just want to comment, thank you for bringing this, Representative Schoen. I have to say, I found all of the testimony to be really riveting, and I don't know if there's any press here today. If there isn't, it's really unfortunate. Oh, good, there's somebody's here, because I think this is, I regret that this isn't getting, really, this should have very wide press coverage, both the problem and the potential solution. I mean, this is really huge, and I just think it's such an important issue. I really appreciate your efforts in carrying this forward, and of course the efforts of Ms. Holtom, whose dedication to making sure that her fiancé's death, you know, is not for nothing, is very, very important. So, you know, thank you to everybody on this. So, Representative Schoen is going to renew his motion that House File 2307 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Schoen. Representative Huntley, House File 2150. Take a deep breath here. All right. Welcome to the committee.
Good to be here, back again. I would move House File 2150 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Okay. Representative Huntley moves that House File 2150 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Go ahead.
Okay. Members, this is really a technical corrections bill to things we passed last year in the Omnibus Health and Human Services Finance Bill. And everything in this bill has come from the Department of Human Services or the Department of Health to make corrections. Many of them are simply date changes the feds approved something, so now we have to change the language that says awaiting federal approval and actually put the dates in, that sort of thing. And I have our finance advisor, Doug Berg, to go through the bill, and if we have more other questions, we have people from Health and Human Services here as well to answer them.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Huntley. Mr. Berg, do you want to, I don't know how much members feel like it's necessary to walk through this. Let me just kind of get a sense of the group here. Would people like Mr. Berg to walk through section by section? I'm not seeing a lot of appetite for that.
We know it.
Yeah, I think a lot of the members do overlap with the Finance Committee, so maybe we can just, we don't have to do that. And are there questions from members to what you've seen here at all? Let me just ask that. All right, I'm not seeing any. So, Mr. Berg, I think you can. I hope you didn't, like, stay up all night preparing.
Madam Chair, I'm fine with that.
All right, so with that, members, I think we can just move and vote the bill out and get it on to the Finance Committee. So Representative Huntley renews his motion. Representative Huntley, you have more to say about it.
No.
Okay. Representative Huntley renews his motion that House File 2150 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, members. And I will say that I learned a long time ago that when the chair wants you to quit talking, you quit go. That when the chair wants you to quit talking, you quit talking.
I'll try to remember that. Representative Johnson, House File 2227.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Johnson moves that House File 2227 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. So, welcome to the committee. Do you want to, Representative Johnson, do you want to say a few words and then we'll introduce your testifiers?
Yes, I'll do that. Thank you. HF 2227 is a piece of a larger picture. It
seeks to create a comprehensive system for treating the most deadly heart attack called STEMI. I understand that as ST, elevation myocardial infarction. Mm-hmm. It's more commonly known as a widowmaker, and that's because it's the most severe heart attack. When STEMI strikes, a patient needs to be rapidly transported to a facility that is capable of opening up the blocked artery. Time is the biggest obstacle, and of course that's critical in rural Minnesota, where transport time can eat up that time. The American Heart Association of Minnesota has launched Mission Lifeline, a large-scale program that focuses on STEMI patients and increases the number of patients who receive life-saving treatments in time. Last year, the American Heart Association secured a $6.5 million grant to fund the development of a rural STEMI system for Minnesota. That's obviously good news, and the first phase has been granting funds directly to rural ambulance services and rural hospitals that are PCI centers in Duluth, St. Cloud, Bemidji, and Mankato. This bill addresses a critical piece, and that is quality of improvement and analysis, and sets us up for a feedback loop that can inform improved practice. Data is collected from the participating rural PCI centers from first medical contact through patient discharge in order to evaluate how the system is working. And this bill then creates a STEMI registry at the Department of Health to receive the data already being voluntarily collected, analyzed, and report for quality improvement assessments. No personal health identifiers are collected, no individual case data is reported, and no single hospital is identified. This is data that is already being voluntarily collected. The bill only provides the method of analysis and reporting for a statewide picture. A STEMI registry is a crucial part of this system because it will inform us how we are doing and give us an opportunity to improve our service. So with that, I'll ask Dr. Ganesh Ravendran to explain more about why the registry is important.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and then go ahead.
Thanks for having us. I'm Ganesh Ravendran. I'm one of the cardiologists at University of Minnesota and have been involved with the American Heart Association Mission Lifeline for the last several years, trying to organize a statewide STEMI system, that is to organize the hospitals that take care of STEMI patients across the state to unify their care. And as a part of that, we have been standardizing the protocols, how the patients are transferred to these hospitals, and also collecting data from each hospitals, we are the receiving hospitals, that is the hospitals that have the cardiac catheterization laboratory to take care of these patients. What we lack here now is the pre-hospital transfer from the small hospital to major hub hospitals, how those hospitals are doing, or what's the process of this hospital transfer process to these major hospitals. There are several databases, several data being collected from several organizations that are mainly focused on the main hub hospitals but not pre-hospital data. This would help us to streamline the transfer process and find the deficits and improve from the deficits we identify from this de-identified data.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm just looking around to see if members have any questions. And I'm not seeing any, so please don't leave. But, we think we can go to our next testifier. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Katie Sahajpal. I'm the Director of Quality and System Improvement Initiatives for the American Heart Association. As was mentioned, we did secure funding to help rural Minnesota develop a STEMI system of care that included funding for equipment for our EMS providers to be able to have 12 leads out in the field so that the rural communities would then have access to pre-hospital identification of a STEMI. Part of this program also looks at the data component. In order to have an effective system and build an effective system, we need to capture data elements to truly understand what the barriers out in the communities are. The Action Registry is a registry that captures the pre-hospital data components for STEMI patients and also the discharge measures for the patients. It actually starts with the time of symptom onset for the patient, so you can actually see how long it is taking, or an average time it is taking, for your community to actually realize that they're having a heart attack, and then how they access that system of care. Ideally, we would like a patient to recognize they're having a heart attack and seek treatment within that first 60 minutes of symptom onset. This would allow the state to have access to that data to see what type of public awareness, community education needs to be done first and foremost to help the community understand what the signs and symptoms are and what they should do whenever they're having a heart attack. Next, it looks at the EMS components. How long is that taking that EMS agent to respond? Are they actually identifying correctly the signs and symptoms of a heart attack and appropriately treating that patient, hooking them up to the 12 lead, which will allow them to identify what type of heart attack they're having, and if indeed they are having that STEMI heart attack, sending them to the appropriate hospital for treatment. It'll look at time, length of transport time, and then we'll also look at how long that patient is waiting in the ER, or are they going straight to the cath lab, which is the currently the appropriate treatment of care for a patient with a STEMI. The golden time frame that we look at for our Mission Lifeline project is our first medical contact, so the time the EMS agent hits that patient to the time that that artery is opened is within 90 minutes. This is a very time-sensitive diagnosis, very similar to our stroke patients. The state already currently has access to a stroke registry, which is also a voluntary registry, to help them improve their times with the stroke patients. This registry would allow the state to have that same access for that de-identified aggregated data to help make improvements to your communities as a whole throughout the state of Minnesota. Finally, it also looks at what happens when the patient is discharged from the hospital. Are they being discharged on the appropriate medications so that when they go back into the community, they are helping reduce their risk factors for another heart attack, or also risk factors for stroke as well, as we know that these diseases are very similarly related with the same risk factors. So it gives a very comprehensive picture of what's going on with STEMI patients in the state, and it also helps to build and improve an effective STEMI system of care.
Okay, thank you. We have a question from Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and I really do appreciate this this bill, because I just experienced this in my life. My husband had the Widowmaker 6 weeks ago. And I took him. I drove him in to the Faribault Hospital, to the emergency room. The 90 minutes was exact, but it seemed like a long 90 minutes to me. And then, of course, he was ambulanced and, you know, pre-opted and started with the medications and all of that in Faribault, and then taken up to, and actually in less than 24 hours, his life was saved. And I he is back in cardiac rehab. So all of these things, you know, are in play, and we are experiencing. And I think that my hospital, I had no idea that they could react and be as life-saving and up to snuff on what's happening in the world of medicine. So the data is excellent. And I often wonder where all this goes. Does anybody really know how wonderful the technology and the treatment is when you get in the situation? So I and to continue that, so that other people in my town can experience the very same life-saving measures that we did 6 weeks ago. So thank you for this bill. Thank you for your testimony and work.
Okay. Other questions or comments from members? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This would be to the Heart Association. Mm-hmm. Can you disclose the source for the funding for that grant program?
And Ms.
So there were several.
I'm sorry. We need to be a little bit formal. And say your name for me again, please.
Katie Sahajpal.
Sahajpal. Thank you. Yes. Go ahead.
There was actually several funders for the Rural Minnesota Mission Lifeline project. The primary funder was the Helmsley Charitable Trust. And then there was other, I will actually refer to Justin Bell with our government relations to discuss if he knows more. I am very focused on my registry side to
all right. And Representative Albright, I'm told that in the packet there is a handout that discusses this.
Yeah, Madam Chair, specifically it lists the Helmsley Charitable Trust with a $4.6 million gift, the Medtronic Foundation with a $300,000 gift, the Otto Bremer Foundation with a $200,000 gift, and the Shakopee Mdewakanton Sioux Community with a $100,000 gift.
Mm-hmm. Okay, did you find that, Representative?
I did, thank you.
Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a couple of, you know, I guess practical applications. It would appear to me, anyway, that with the advent of electronic medical records and the technological age that we live in, most large health care organizations are going to be collecting this data anyway. So my first question is, why would we need to, in a sense, recreate the mousetrap? If we already have the data being collected by other organizations, surely for process improvement, for outcomes improvement, the very nature of the medical profession is to desire to improve outcomes for their patients. Why is it necessary that we would need this over something that's already established?
Ms. Sahajpal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you are correct. Most hospitals do collect their internal data. They actually have to report their acute myocardial infarction data to CMS on those patients who are over 65. Currently, there's no system, though, in place to look at the data as a whole. Typically, they tend not to look at the pre-hospital data, and as studies have shown, actually, that while a lot of facilities are focused on their door to balloon time, it's actually that whole symptom onset to balloon time that makes a difference in reducing mortality and morbidity of STEMI patients. So as the state having access to this data and submitting this data voluntarily to this registry so that the state can look at it, it will allow for the improvement of the pre-hospital measures that would be very important to in reducing the risk of death out in our rural communities and our STEMI patients.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Albright.
Why would it be incumbent upon the state to tell the medical profession about the dissemination of this information? Why wouldn't we want to provide it directly to the healthcare providers and not the state?
So with the Action Registry, the hospitals will actually receive their own individual data along with the state benchmark too. Very similar with the Stroke Registry is that once the state can see the data, they can start to help with types of education, quality improvement, as I mentioned, community awareness component. As a whole, I think the more that we drill in those signs and symptoms of risk factors for the public from all routes and avenues, the better that message hits home so that whenever they are having that heart attack, they are able to recognize and call 911. And I think that the more public awareness that anyone and everyone, health providers, EMS agencies, and the state can offer that education is critical. And having tracking our outcomes, why do we continue to do public education, looking at EMS times? The state has a, for EMS, their medical board as well, so that they can see how they're doing overall with their transport times and what they're doing. So it's kind of a whole team-based approach to care so that your communities and your STEMI patients are receiving each and every treatment that they're eligible for in a timely fashion.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
This database that you're creating or that you propose to create includes a lot of private information, even if it is benign to name and rank and serial number, if you will. Wondering if you could respond to who has access to that information once it's collected, what privacy measures are put in place over that data?
Yes.
And Mrs., you need to go through the chair
okay.
to speak to the body.
Sorry. So the Action Registry is a national registry for acute myocardial infarction patients. They actually, through that registry, look at STEMI and non-STEMI patients. all of the data that's entered by a hospital that would be generated for the reports for the state would be de-identified aggregated data. So they're not going to be able to capture which hospital is submitting which data, and they're not going to be able to see which patient came from which facility. It's all an aggregated report. I believe that in your handouts there is a sample copy of what a report, just one page of the report, looks like. Mm-hmm. I have actually a full 9-page report that I'd be happy to share with the group as well. But you can see that it's all aggregated data. The Action Registry does have several privacy acts in place for hospitals that are submitting data to make sure that their data is secure and private.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright, just for information, this bill will be referred to civil law, where they will continue to ask these questions around the data practice pieces of the bill.
And I certainly appreciate that, but I get the real sense that we're setting a new precedent here, and as a matter of policy, I think it's incumbent upon this committee to explore that, in addition, because of our responsibilities to the healthcare community. So if you'll indulge me for a couple more questions.
I will indulge you for a couple more questions, Representative Albright.
Thank you. I'm a patient who is on the verge or in the process of suffering from a widowmaker.
That's it.
Is this information disclosure release part of my HIPAA signature, or is it a separate form? How am I acknowledging release of this data to this data field?
Mrs. Sahajpal?
Sahajpal.
Yes.
Madam Chair. So the hospital who is submitting the data, they pay a licensing fee to enter all of their STEMI patients into this registry on a voluntary basis. They do the same on the stroke side. And they also, whenever they are reporting for CMS, they are sending all of their de-identified patient information to the CMS. So it's kind of dependent whenever they go into the hospital, them signing their privacy papers with their hospital, how the hospital reports and tracks their measures for quality improvement purposes.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one final question. So, in a sense, we are providing an opportunity for CMS to govern evidence-based treatment programs for the doctors going forward.
Madam Chair. No, this is completely separate from CMS. Hospitals right now are required to submit data on their patients from the time that patient hits their hospital. That information is already being submitted to CMS for Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement. This is something that's different. It captures a completely additional patient population. CMS is only looking at those patients that they're getting reimbursement from. This registry would allow hospitals to track and monitor their patients of all ages, of all insurance payer mix.
I'm nothing further.
Okay, are there other questions for members? Okay, we have another testifier. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Twyla Braze. And I want to remind members that this bill is going to civil law, so here in the Health Committee, we are not concerned about the data practices, we're only concerned about the health issues. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and I have taken a look at this bill and would like to draw some pieces of it to your attention. What I think I'm going to do first is just look at the sections of the bill, and so I'm look, for instance, at line 1.9, where it says continuous quality improvement of care. So one of the things that we always like to ask is to make sure people understand what the word quality is and who defines quality. And the fact of the matter is, consider that as you look at the rest of the bill, because when we look at the bill, what we see here is a research bill. In other words, when you go into the hospital for a heart attack, what you end up being is part of a research study. Now, we looked at the action registry, GWTG, which is guidelines, I can't remember what it means. But anyway, it means following the guidelines. And so if you just look at all the information that's going to be collected on someone, you can tell that this is about a research project. And these are people who are coming into the hospital for treatment, and they don't know that they're part of a research project. And so I looked a little bit at something from a Hastings report from the Hastings Institute, which says that, and so what we're talking about here is continuous quality improvement, right? And it says, well-designed, well-implemented quality improvement activities are similar in many ways to human subjects research, especially as it is defined in the Common Rule, a systematic investigation including research, development, testing, and evaluation designed to develop or contribute to generalizable knowledge. And it's what we're looking at here is not just building a database, but the database is going to be part of conducting research on patients. If we go down a little bit further, I do note as was...
Hayes, if I could just stop you right there. So what you're talking about, is that going to help or hurt the health of patients? Because that's what we're about here in this committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, if you look at line 2.1, one of our great concerns is actually if you look at line 1.11, it says the commissioner shall. And then you get to line 2.1, and it says require the application of evidence-based treatment guidelines. So the commissioner, the government, is going to require the application of evidence-based treatment guidelines. Now, I've done two reports on evidence-based medicine, which I looked at peer-reviewed studies, and the peer-reviewed researchers actually disagree greatly about what evidence-based medicine is, and talk many of them about the biases or the subjects or who was chosen, how many they did, where those studies were done, right? So what we're really talking about here is the commissioner being able to require whatever the commissioner decides is evidence-based treatment guidelines. So when you ask about the question of whether this will hurt or harm patients, I think there's two things at play here. One is, what are the guidelines that are going to be required and considered evidence-based, and are they going to work? And it's the pressure that's put on the doctor when they are scored according to their compliance with these guidelines. And the second thing is just the individual's trust and the state's interference in the patient-doctor relationship. Now, if you look at the handout this morning called Minnesota STEMI Registry, it's important to just know what it says. So in the overview, which is the start of the second column on page one, it says a clinical registry is a database of health information on specific clinical conditions, procedures, or populations. And then if you go to the bottom of that, it says with data from a clinical registry, researchers can identify and evaluate healthcare disparities within a patient population, examine underrepresented populations, investigate disease progression, collect data on gender, race, ethnicity, language, and other health indicators. Very clearly, this is all about creating a research project in the state of Minnesota. But then you also go a little further where it says measuring quality and safety. It says that it will identify unnecessary or inappropriate variation. Well, according to whom? Because not every patient is the same. And in fact, we had an evidence-based, in fact, we had a clinical trialist, is what he called himself, a cardiologist from the Henry Ford Medical System in Michigan, come and talk at a seminar, and he talked about all the patients when he did research that were taken out of the study for this reason or that reason. But he said they're all going to come in. They're all going to have these kind of health conditions, and we never did any kind of study about what would happen to them. So if you look at the second bullet under measuring quality and safety, it says examining provider adherence to safety protocols and best practice guidelines. And then, so that for us shows how the whole idea here is to direct the practice of medicine according to whatever the health department or other outsiders say. And then underneath that it says that the Minnesota Department of Health will serve as a neutral body, but the police But the health department actually has police power, and a lot of these patients are going to be paid for by the state of Minnesota. So we see a lot of pressure actually on doctors to do whatever the state of Minnesota is going to tell them. And if you look finally at the last bullet point right above the United States, you'll see that it says encourage use of registries as an efficient data collection tool as part of payment and delivery reform initiatives. So the concern that I have, Madam Chair and members, is that this is a large research project on people who are coming in to the hospital. They are getting real-time data on them, and the data will be used to direct the practice of medicine according to whomever is happening to be in that director's position. So we look at that as this is interfering with the process of care. There's no consent for the patients to be part of this research initiative. And it's, of course, forcing doctors perhaps to consider whether or not to treat the patient the way they want to, or to be assured of as much reimbursement as they really want and treat them the way whatever these best practice guidelines, evidence-based guidelines are that the commissioner is going to require. So that is our concern, and therefore we would oppose the bill, unless, of course, you add consent, fully informed consent.
We have a question from Representative Schoen. Representative Schoen?
Madam Chair, Ms. Brees, so the chair asked the question, is it good for health care or not? And then you talked about how you wrote some papers talking about health care. What's your medical training?
Madam Chair and Representative Schoen, I have a history as an emergency room nurse.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Schoen.
I guess out of all that confusion you just laid on us, so is health research, is it good for patients or not?
Madam Chair and Representative Schoen, health research is good for patients if the patients want to be part of it. If they become involuntary research subjects, it actually goes against the Nuremberg Code and all sorts of other, the Belmont Report, that say that really the patient needs to trust that they are not a research subject.
Okay. And let me just ask Representative Johnson, are individual identities collected, or is there individual patient, is consent needed here, or why not?
Madam Chair, no, there are no, individuals are not identified. This is aggregate data, and this is about improving healthcare based on data, aggregate data for the experience of this project. I have no, in my opinion, as someone who lives in rural Minnesota and knows people who live in more rural Minnesota than I do, this is a valuable tool to improve service for heart attack victims throughout the state. And it speeds the service. It provides care right at the site where it's happening, speeds people off to where they can get the quality care, and it's going to save lives. And so that's why I'm a strong supporter of this bill. And the information is a feedback loop that allows us to improve medical service in this state. It's important to do that.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Ms. Brace.
Madam Chair, as the Hastings report says, it should be noted that informed consent is not solely about protecting individuals from research risks. It is a requirement that ensures that the right to self-determination is realized, that is, that individuals be given the opportunity to choose what shall and shall not happen to them. Our concern is that we definitely have a concern about the fact of whether it's individualized data, but our real concern here in this case is that people are being entered into a research project that will potentially impact their access to care and have their doctors making decisions from outsiders, not directly according to whatever their individual needs are. So our concern for consent is that they are being added to a research project without their knowledge.
Okay, other questions from members? Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess more so just a comment and follow-up to Representative Schoen. I guess it was a lot of information. I didn't think it was too confusing. You laid out a case where you kind of followed the trails and linked it back to the bill and the language. And what I drew from that in trying to closely follow along with what you're saying, and I'm not sure necessarily if it completely compels me away from what's trying to happen here in the bill, but that the issue is around some of the language where it talks about that the commissioner shall require based on evidence-based treatment. And to me, that wasn't that hard to follow. The line that you were trying to explain, Ms. Brace, that is where it could impede the quality health care if there's differing opinions, as is common in the medical community. There's never 100% consensus, and I think we at the health committee understand that it's a very complicated, it's not as black and white as any of us ever want it to be. But my understanding is the case that's being made is that onus that's being put on the commissioner to require that the evidence-based treatment is put in the guidelines that I understand there's not a lot of wiggle room for a practitioner to move within those guidelines. They're laid out for them. That's where the concern is of your organization in terms of how it would impede health care. And that can be argued, but I guess it was a lot of information for us to digest, and I was trying to follow, and if I'm understanding to the question that was laid out to you, that's the point that you're trying to make in terms of why it may or may not hurt health care.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Brace.
Madam Chair and Representative Mack, that is correct. And we also do think that this is starting something potentially new where if we get this into place, when is the next research project? When is the next specific gathering of data? Will it be diabetics? Will it be asthmatics? Will it be, whatever you want to come up with, where they decide that they will gather the data and then put out so-called evidence-based practice protocols and then make it difficult for physicians not to follow those, and therefore they are controlling the practice of medicine rather than having the practitioner who's actually seeing the patient, who has a relationship and who has an obligation, a professional obligation, to practice according to the individual, not according to outside standardized practices that may not work for that individual.
Okay, well, before I go to Representative Zerwas, at some point we may have more time to discuss what it means to have something be evidence-based, and that seems to be what this discussion is moving around. But that I think that's just a small part of this bill. If members think it's a large part, maybe I could ask the physician who's here to come back and comment on that, because to my understanding, evidence-based guidelines doesn't mean that a physician is bound to do something in a certain way, and he's nodding his head. Not only that, you know, sometimes we get into this kind of, I would say, you know, fear scenario. We can draw these things out and worry about them. And maybe in some cases there's cause to do that. But I think when we think about medicine, if people don't like the idea that evidence gets gathered and that from that evidence we figure out what we should be doing in particular situations, mm-hmm. I don't think you should take any drugs. I don't think you should go to your doctor, because how do they learn? How do they figure out what to do in an individual situation? You know, it's by looking at patient after patient after patient. And, of course, that, you know, some people say that the plural of anecdote is data. Well, it isn't. And because you can look at, you know, a physician may see four patients with some similar things and think they know everything about that situation. And they may be seeing four patients who are different in some way. So the way to have the best care is to have research. Everything we do in medicine today, the things that are the most successful are based on research. And if people want to go back from that and get rid of all the data, I think there might be countries in the world where you could go for your medical care, but you probably wouldn't want to. So, you know, there is a balance to be struck here, and we try on this committee, I think, to strike that balance, not saying that everybody's medical data should be available for everything, but that there is certainly an appropriate use and need to have data so that the individual then can receive the best possible treatment and the physician can have some guidelines to start from. If you all think we need to talk more about evidence-based medicine, we do have a physician here. I think he'd be glad to come up and explain more about that, but I think I'll go to Representative Zerwas and hope that we can kind of move on from that topic. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'll just perhaps wrap up this portion in saying that, you know, let's go back to what this bill is really about. This is about creating a statewide response for a severe, in many cases, life-ending cardiac infarction. And as someone that's been down this path a couple times, and as someone that's had 10 open heart surgeries, I think we need a standardized system in the state of Minnesota so that if a patient has a severe cardiac event in Minneapolis, or if they're at their cabin in Cross Lake, or they're in Silver Bay, when they go to their clinical provider, usually by ambulance, we heard earlier that in northwestern or southwestern Minnesota, it might be 30 or 40 minutes later when they go by ambulance. When they get to that first spot for that care to be delivered, there's a standardized protocol and a standardized system. It's similar to what we did with the stroke system bill last year. Now, to be able to come up with those standards, be able to deliver that standardized care, you have to have the information. The information is aggregate, where it's population-based. If you're afraid of what's listed as data on this example report, come on. There are real concerns about healthcare privacy and healthcare data. This isn't it. Get over it. Just go with that. Come on.
Thank you, Representative Sirwas. Appreciate that.
Madam Chair.
I didn't ask a question.
He didn't ask a question. Okay, I think we're ready to vote, members, if there's no other testimony. So, okay, Representative Johnson is going to renew his motion that House File 2227 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Johnson. And Representative Fritz, final bill of the morning. Wow.
Anybody here?
Welcome to the committee. I think. Wonder if we should all take a break here, fan ourselves with the papers or something.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I do know CPR and a couple of couple others in here as well. So
yes, indeed. Thank you.
I'm going to turn the dial down a little bit, but again, I thank you, Madam Chair and members, for hearing our bill.
Okay. So Representative Fritz is going to move that House File 1295 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. So go ahead, Representative Fritz.
And I do have a testifier here as well, Mary Jo George, but I'll just talk a little bit to refresh your memory. This is a bill that will keep people my age, 69, 70, 75, 80, who are in, have an elderly waiver service, who will keep them in their homes, in the assisted living facilities that they are in. My bill allows seniors who were expected to lose their elderly waiver service due to eligibility changes to continue on the program as long as they had been enrolled in the elderly waiverly program for at least 90 days. You may recall the governor postponed these cuts until 2015 to ensure that we have adequate supports to place. As you know, elderly waiver is very cost effective and has been successful in keeping seniors living in the community and out of the more expensive nursing homes. We know things can go downhill fast for frail seniors and do not have confidence that the processes are in place to adjust to these changes. From a policy perspective, this bill creates a parity for what we do in current law, which is to allow seniors who are now residing in nursing homes to stay even if they do not meet the stricter eligibility guidelines. And with that, I'll stop and turn it over to Mary Jo George.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Mary Jo George, and I'm here on behalf of AARP Minnesota, and we appreciate the opportunity to testify, and we want to thank Representative Fritz for bringing this bill forward. As Representative Fritz indicated, this bill would allow seniors that are on the elderly waiver program to continue on that program as long as they've been enrolled for 90 days.
I think as we testified last year in the budget committees before you, we really believe there is a potential for harm and costly nursing home placements and possibly hospitalizations if seniors fall through the cracks and no longer have the services and supports that they need. And why we structured it this way is because of what we thought is current law. We are doing this for seniors in nursing homes, which we agree with, but we understand the department may have some concerns around this language, but we are hopeful that they will work with us to look at ways that how we could mitigate the harm that we think could happen as seniors are transferred to programs that we think are less robust and possibly inadequate. Real quickly, briefly, we have three concerns with the transition programs. The first is the Essential Community Support Program. The allocation, we believe, is not sufficient to meet the needs. It's only a $400 a month grant, and these seniors, on average, according to the department's own analysis, are spending at least $700 a month, and they're using services that go beyond the Essential Community Grant Program. So, for example, vital home care services that they can't get from Medicare necessarily. So we're concerned about that. We think also the proposal fails to understand the different income and asset eligibility and standards that we have between our elderly waiver program and our state Medicaid plan benefits. And so what's going to happen as a result of this is there are going to be some seniors that have high medical needs that will have to spend thousands of dollars more out of pocket to retain services under Medicaid. I think you guys have been talking a lot about the spend down that you've been hearing about. It's similar to that in a waiver. There's a waiver obligation, which is different than a spend down, but they would have to go below poverty now to stay on the program. And finally, I think our third concern is we have concerns around the potential loss of housing. I think as Representative Fritz indicated, we are concerned about seniors who may have sold their home, moved into assisted living, because neither of these transition programs pay for this service package. And so we think the possibility of seniors may be left without affordable housing options. So with that, we want to, again, thank you, and we hope we can continue to work with the department to figure out ways to mitigate the harm. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. George. I just have one little question on the date on the page 2 of the bill.
Okay.
Effective date.
Oh, yeah.
Is that going to, because we want it retroactive, or is that just because it hasn't been fixed? Ms. George?
Well, we introduced this last year, and so these cuts were supposed to go into effect January 2015, but now they're not going to go into effect till January 2015. So I think we could structure it with a 2015 date.
Okay.
For it to be applicable.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, certainly. And I'm sure we can fix this in finance as well. You know, I'm sure that'll be considered with where the funding is and so on. So I don't think we need to do anything now. I was just curious about it. Members, any questions? Okay, thank you. I think we're okay then, and so I think is there any public testimony? Anyone else in the audience would like to speak to this bill? Representative Fritz, any closing words?
Does Jean want to come? Okay, good.
All right. okay, so we have somebody from DHS in there, and DHS doesn't need to comment on the bill at this time. Okay. Very good. So Representative Fritz will renew her motion that House File 1295 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Fritz.
Thank
you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
And we are adjourned.
Thank you.